From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It is the 25th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. K-State's Dan O'Brien will be here. He'll take up the energy markets with us. And in the second half hour of our program, that's a program we call The Farming World, and it airs on many of these stations or online always at willag.org. Tom Hurdle, the executive director for the Center for Global Trade Analysis at Purdue University, will be here. He's co-authored a paper called Effects of U.S. Maize Ethanol on Global Land Use and Greenhouse Gas Emissions, Estimating Market-Mediated Responses. We'll talk about what all that means during the farming world. And don't forget, in just 26 minutes right here, Don Day will join us for a look at the agricultural weather forecast on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Here are the Tuesday afternoon settlement prices from Chicago at the CME Group. Nearby July wheat at $4.16.5, down 7. September at $4.78, 7 lower. And December wheat at $5.08.75 for the soft red, 7.75 lower. In Kansas City, the harvest month there, July futures down 5.75 at $4.84.75 a bushel. From the corn pit back in Chicago, nearby July corn, 3.64 1/4, 6.75 lower. September, 3.73 1/4, down 6.75. December, 6.25 lower at 3.82 3/4. And the March futures at 3.95.5, down 5.5 cents. May corn next year, $4.04 1/4, down 5 cents. July soybean futures, 9.30 1/2, a dime lower. August at 9.21, down 14. September at 9.09 1/2, down 13 1/4. And November soybeans at $9.03, down 12 1/2. The January at 9.12 3/4 for 2011, down 12 cents. Bean meal, July contract, 271.10, down 260. July soybean oil at 37.17, down 35 cents. Live cattle futures from the CME Group. June contract, $90.02 1/2, $1.10 lower. May feeders at 108 even, down 7 1/2 cents. For the August, down 1.57 1/2 at 107.27 1/2. And the June lean hog futures today at $81.15, settled 72 1/2 cents lower. July at $82 even, down 37 1/2 cents. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media in Urbana-Champaign. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, July contract, $68.75 a barrel, under 70 bucks, down $1.46 for the day. June ethanol at $1.58, down 2 3/10. Natural gas at $4.07 1/2, 5 8/10 higher for the day. And the RBOB gasoline at $1.93 9/10, down 3 1/10 cents. Diesel fuel or heating oil at $1.87 6/10, that's down 2 2/10. And the gold futures at $1,197.80, a settlement price up $4. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 9,962, that's right under 10,000 points, down 102 points at the hour. And the Goldman Sachs at 466.72 is down 7.06 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like from our own Mike Solom. He says tonight should be mainly clear to partly cloudy in some of the areas. A few isolated thunderstorms are possible. Lows will range between 62 and 68 this evening. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, hot and humid. Isolated thunderstorms will be primarily during the afternoon. Highs will range from near 80 in northwestern Illinois to 92 in the southeastern parts of central Illinois locations. Isolated thunderstorms will drop heavy but very localized rainfall over the next few days. A cold front is expected to bring wider coverage of rainfall on Thursday and Thursday night. And that'll be followed by somewhat cooler and less humid air, which should settle in for the Memorial Day weekend. However, temperatures should remain slightly above average. High temperatures will range from the upper 70s in the north to the mid-80s in the south. And the lows should be in the 50s north to the 60s in the south. Scattered showers and thunderstorms in western Corn Belt will cause some interruptions of bean planting there. A more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with Don Day.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Usually we talk with Wayne Nelson at the offices of L&M in Newmarket, Indiana. That's not the case today. L&M Commodities' John Hester is with us instead. Wayne's out of the office. Thanks for filling in, John. We appreciate that.
Hey, thanks very much. I enjoy it.
Now, kind of an interesting day. Let's start with the Dow Jones Industrial Average. How important is it that it's broken below 10,000?
I think 10,000 was a support area, and, you know, really it needs to close above it. I think, which it very easily could do, it has been firming up all day, and we're at 99.65 now. So, you know, we're in reach of closing back above 10,000, but I think it's the 10,000 number is a just a security blanket number that everybody hopes it will hold. And I've read a couple articles that they think it may go back down to 7,000-8,000 again. So I don't know.
Crude oil futures below $70, and did that help precipitate the losses in the corn and the bean pits?
I think it probably did to some extent between it and the Dow, but it has firmed back up a little bit. It was down over $2 at one time, and over the period of the day, it's firmed up a little bit. I think the main thing that drove the commodity markets lower today was the debt concerns in Europe, and the fact that the euro is trading on right at contract lows and the dollar is on 14, 15-month highs, and that lowers their buying power if they want to buy any of our products.
And you consider that that will continue to happen for some time?
I think there's a possibility. Of course, you know, then the spread between the euro and the dollar could, you know, reverse itself at any time. But right now, that is the trend, the dollar going up and the euro retreating.
John, we appreciate you being with us for the day.
Hey, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
You too. John Hester is with L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Tuesday afternoon, filling in for Wayne Nelson, who was out of the office today.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Well, by the last week's end, 93% of the 2010 corn crop was planted. That compares with 80% last year and 89% for the rolling five-year average, says the United States Department of Agriculture. A second week of persistent Midwestern storms again hampered field work throughout much of the Corn Belt, where planting progress, with the exception of South Dakota, was limited to 7 percentage points or less during the week. Emergence for corn now leaving progress at 71% complete, 21 percentage points ahead of the last year and 9 percentage points ahead of the five-year average. Above average temperatures promoted emergence, of course, of 18 percentage points or more across the Great Lakes region, as well as in Colorado, Nebraska, and North Dakota, led by double-digit improvements in Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, and North Carolina. 71% of the nation's corn crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's up 4 points from last week. Soybeans nationally, 53% of the bean crop planted by May the 23rd. 9 points ahead of last year, 4 points behind the five-year average. The most significant delay still evident in Missouri, where an abundance of rainfall had provided producers just 2 days suitable for field work during the past 2 weeks, and resulting in an overall delay of 21 points, or about 8 days. Nationwide, soybean emergence has advanced to 24% complete, 9 percentage points ahead of last year, and 1 point ahead of the 5-year average. Now, here are the statisticians from Indiana, Minnesota, Nebraska, Illinois, and Iowa with updates from their regions.
This is Greg Tayson, director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending May 23, 2010. Warmer, drier weather in northern and west central Iowa allowed farmers in those areas to get out in the fields again this week. Producers got back to planting crops, spraying weeds, and harvesting hay after one of the wettest weeks in 2 years. With the improved conditions last week, most crops have recovered from the frost and cooler weather experienced earlier in the month. Only a few reports have indicated the need to replant. Meanwhile, the southeast part of the state received more rain last week on already saturated fields, which continued to limit field work. Counties in southeast Iowa have received over 10 inches of rain so far this month, which has caused concerns about emerged corn that is lacking color, and that standing water in low-lying fields may not permit newly planted crops to survive. 98% of the corn acreage has been planted and 84% has emerged. With emergence 14 percentage points ahead of normal, the condition of the crop is rated 65% good to excellent. Soybean planting was 75% complete, just above last year and the 5-year average, while emergence at 28% was 6 points ahead of the normal pace. This season's first reports of soybean condition rated the crop that has emerged at 1% very poor, 6% poor, 33% fair, 49% good, and 11% excellent. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending May 23rd. The second week of above-normal rainfall kept most producers out of their fields, the exception being those on foot who were scouting previously planted corn and soybean fields. And what they were finding is the need to do more replanting due to ponding and flooding. But fortunately for most, the weekend brought above-normal temperatures and a stiff breeze to begin the drying process and return corn to a rich green growing color. Statewide, corn planting is winding down at 97% complete. This is well ahead of last year's weather-delayed 56%, with the 5-year average for this period being 87%. Emergence advanced to 87% compared to 20% emerged last year and 69% for the 5-year average. The average height of emerged corn advanced by only 2 inches last week due to cool, wet conditions and now stands at an average 6 inches compared with 4 inches last year and 5 inches for the 5-year average. Overall, the corn crop was rated in mostly good condition. Soybean planting advanced to 47% complete, compared to 10% planted last year and 54% for the 5-year average. 27% of soybeans have emerged, compared to 1% a year ago and 24% for the 5-year average. The crop reporting district leading the state in soybean emergence was the Eastern District at 42%. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 81% headed, and this compares to 77% last year and 83% for the 5-year average. 28% of the wheat heads were reported filled, compared with 17% 1 year ago and 34% for the 5-year average. 1% of the fields were reported turning yellow, compared to 5% for the 5-year average. The condition of the wheat crop was rated in fair to good condition. However, a few fields were reported prematurely turning yellow due to nitrogen deficiency. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending May 23, 2010. Crop development and progress of field work were once again slowed by cool, wet, and windy conditions across the state. Most areas of the state received precipitation, with the South Central District receiving over 1.5 inches. However, the Northeast District has only had 2/3 of normal rainfall since April 1st. Corn conditions rated 2% poor, 21 fair, 66 good, and 11 excellent. Corn planting neared completion at 96% statewide. Corn emerged was 59% complete, behind last year's 73 and 68 average. Soybean planting was 63% complete, behind last year's 84 and 70 average. Soybeans emerged was 15% behind last year's 36 and 24 average. Sorghum planting was at 21% complete. Wheat conditions rated 75% good or excellent, above the 70% of last year. Wheat jointed was at 78% and 6% was headed out. Alfalfa rated 88% good or excellent. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending May 23, 2010. Warm weather throughout the week allowed soybean producers to make significant planting progress. As of May 23rd, soybean planting advanced 34 percentage points to 81% complete, compared to 72% last year and 64% for the five-year average. Other crops nearing planting completion include canola, potatoes, and green peas. Temperatures reached the highest level so far this year, and highs were approximately 5 degrees above normal during the reporting period. Scattered precipitation affected the central and southern areas of the state, however produced no significant accumulation. Corn was 78% emerged, 11 points ahead of last year and 21 points ahead of the average, with 87% of the crop rated in good or excellent condition. Spring wheat and barley jointing advanced to 14 and 10% respectively. Both crops were rated 93% in good or excellent condition. That's the weekly crop weather report for the week ending May 23, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana, and this is the crop weather report for the week ending May 23rd. Persistent rain for the week over most of the state kept field work at a standstill. The soybean planting pace fell behind the five-year average due to the wet field conditions. Some flooding in low-lying areas and along waterways will cause some replanting of field crops to be needed. Weedy fields have been reported due to wet fields limiting farmers' ability to spray herbicides. 88% of the intended corn acreage has been planted, still ahead of last year's 51% planted at this time and the five-year average of 79%. By area of the state, 88% has been planted in the north, 93% has been planted in the central region, and 77% in southern Indiana. 79% of the planted corn acreage has emerged ahead of the 19% recorded for last year and the 56% for the five-year average. 50% of the intended soybean acreage has been planted, compared to 22% for last year and 51% for the five-year average. 34% of the planted soybean acreage has emerged well ahead of the 3% recorded for last year and the 22% for the five-year average. 81% of the winter wheat acreage is headed, compared with 68% for last year and 67% for the five-year average. Winter wheat condition fell slightly from last week and is rated at 70% good to excellent, compared to 77% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. This note and question for those of you who listen to The Farming World, that's the second half hour of the program that some of you can hear on this radio station or online at Will Ag. We need to know whether you like the program or not and whether it's worth doing. So give us a call at 217-333-9697. That's 217-333-9697. Or email me at tgleason@illinois.edu, tgleason@illinois.edu. With your comments and suggestions, we need both the good and the bad of the farming world.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
This is the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. Dan O'Brien of K-State University, ag economist there in their Northwest Research Extension Center in Colby, Kansas, joins us to take a look this afternoon on a Tuesday at the agricultural energy markets. Thanks for being with us, Dan.
Yes, Todd. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. You sent me a little paper that retired Extension ag economist Bob Wisner from Iowa State and you penned and presented in Indianapolis in the earlier part of May, looking at distillers' grains in the United States and trying to discern what supply and demand might look like through the year, I think, 2019 or 2020. What did you find?
Well, under the current scenario where we've approved 10% ethanol fuel blends with other fuels, other primary gasoline, we found that, first of all, adequate feed usage capacity seems to exist for the use of the distiller's grains that we'd be producing. Again, we're producing distiller's grains to match the renewable fuel standard that will take us to 15 billion gallons by year 2015. So under E10, it seems that we have enough room to go ahead and make use of the distiller's grains that are produced, even under E11. We even have enough room under E15, although with that much more distiller's grains supply out there, the market will be just at time, seasonally at least, that much more crowded, and probably the possibility for more volatility both up and down with the higher fuel blends.
For the volatility in the price of corn or the price of DDGs?
Well, that is a really interesting question. You'll have two commodities occupying the same market space: corn, which can be stored for longer periods of time, and distiller's grains, which needs to be used up, just because it tends to degrade faster. So you literally have you'll have all that many more pounds, tons, equivalent bushels of distiller's grains competing head-to-head with corn, and you'll have one of those commodities, i.e. distiller's grains, that will need to move. Again, it tends to not store for long periods of time, at least not as well as corn. So the volatility, if anything, will probably be more so on the distiller's grain side, I would hypothesize anyway, as opposed to corn.
Did you try to predict what the export and domestic side of that supply or demand would look like?
Yes, well, we assumed that the rates of exports of distiller's grains were going to remain at about the 20-21% level. I've seen numbers up to 25% and 30%. So we projected that out into the 2019-2020 year, and then looked at the impact of increased ethanol usage on the amount of grain that would be left for use, either to go to exports or to livestock feeding. And it seems if we do move to, say, at E13, E14, E15, that there'll be a good amount of competition, it'll be the polite thing to say, between the remaining users of corn, i.e. those that are using corn domestically for feed use as opposed to international users that are buying corn for their feed use issues. Again, I think if we move towards E15, at least our preliminary analysis would indicate that there'll be a fair amount of price competition for the remaining bushels to see who gets to feed their livestock with it.
Would that have much of an impact in a bad way on margins at the ethanol plant?
If prices move higher for corn, yes, that ceteris paribus, everything held equal, is what the economists say, everything else equal, yes, that would be a negative. But what's not being really dealt with here is that if you increase your renewable fuel standard by that much, then you'll be driving the price up for ethanol as well to some degree. So it may be a wash in the long run, depending how it all comes out.
Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Yeah, we'll talk to you in a month. Dan O'Brien is at K-State University. He's an extension professional there. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day will be here in 2 minutes to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's National Wine Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1789, Anders Dahl died. A renowned Swedish botanist, the dahlia flower was named for him. The bushy perennial plant is native to Mexico, Central America, and Colombia. The Aztecs gathered and cultivated the plant for food, ceremony, as well as decorative purposes. In 1882, the first frozen mutton from New Zealand arrived in Britain. In 1986, about 7 million Americans participated in Hands Across America by holding hands and singing across 4,150 miles of road in support of the hungry and homeless. Participants paid $10 to reserve their place in line. The proceeds were donated to local charities. The longest unbroken part of the chain was allegedly in Illinois. And in 2007, Coca-Cola created a 3,000-gallon, 15-foot-high ice cream float with vanilla Coke and ice cream and set a new world record for the largest ice cream float in history. The float weighed in at 10 tons. A tanker from the Atlanta-based company's syrup plant pumped a non-carbonated mixture into a specially made 15-foot-high glass containing a device that carbonated the beverage. Workers dropped buckets full of ice cream into the top of the glass by hand. By the way, the float was certified as drinkable by health inspectors. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, is on the line to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Don, it's an interesting weather world in the United States. What do you see?
Well, you can cut the country in half. You can have the western side of the country that's had a stormy, cold, and wet weather pattern for the last couple of weeks, while here in the Midwest and areas along and east of the Mississippi, it's been pretty warm. Temperatures have been off to a real warm start this spring, so it's a sort of a 50-50 weather pattern, and that is not unusual when you get a jet stream that's sort of stuck. That's what we have. We have a persistent area of low pressure in the Pacific Northwest, stretching south into California, even into the desert southwest, while high pressure has been very sturdy here in the Midwest. And so we're sort of in a log jam right now, which has kept the weather pattern quite persistent, and we expect that to continue into, probably at least the early parts of June.
Now you've got more of the white stuff, and it's kind of cold for May out where you are, isn't it?
Yeah, in fact, it's going to end up being a record cold May in many areas of the western United States, from California to Colorado. Many areas of the Rockies reported snow all the way down to 5,000 to 6,000 feet. We have snowpacks that are now 150 to 200% of normal, not so much because a lot of snow's fallen, but it just hasn't melted. California, Washington, and Oregon, into Idaho, looking at some very cool weather. Salt Lake City had their latest May snow on record. So while we're blistering here in some very warm temperatures in the Midwest, out west it's been cooler. Now, some of that cooler weather is going to translate eastward into here this weekend and into next week. Don't think we'll have a big drop in temperature, Todd, but we should expect thunderstorm and shower activity to likely pick up.
That's the other thing. It's not only been warm here, but it's awfully humid. That's mostly because of the rainfall ahead of a lot of the heat that's come in, though pop-up thunderstorms and showers are abundant across some of the areas. Do you think we'll get much more rainfall?
Yeah, what we're going to see is a continuation of what we've had, which is these showers and thunderstorms popping up, nothing that's going to be terribly organized, but enough to keep us in a weather pattern where I don't think we've got any long periods of dryness coming. In fact, I would say from what we're seeing over the next couple of weeks, we don't see any significant or heavier focused rains, but several opportunities that we'll get some.
Given their buying pattern at the Chicago Board of Trade, it sure looks like China could use a good growing season. It hadn't started that way. Is it getting any better?
Well, you know, what's been interesting across the Northern Hemisphere is there's been a lot of folks with similar weather patterns, and China's weather pattern has been pretty similar to ours in terms of temperatures that in some spots have been warm, some spots have been cool, and now they're looking at what should be some pretty significant rainfall. There could be some areas that get maybe a little bit too much rain in portions of China here over the next couple of weeks, while temperature readings are going to be averaging below normal, some parts of China well below normal.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. If you can, stay with us for the farming world. Otherwise, we'll say goodbye to you now, and you can listen to us online at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Tom Hurdle. Mr. Hurdle is a distinguished professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, and its executive director for the Center for Global Trade Analysis. His research focuses on the economy-wide impacts of global trade and environmental policies. Our topic with him today is very large. We'll take up greenhouse gases and the role of ethanol. Mr. Hurdle, welcome to the program. You were a lead researcher on a paper exploring this subject. Let's start from the beginning, if we can, and I think this may be the beginning, but you can correct me if that's not. Why do we need to know the impact of using ethanol as a fuel as it pertains to greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, we are increasingly concerned about greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. There is more and more evidence that these concentrations are altering the climate, resulting in global warming, resulting in changes in the pattern of rainfall. And there's concern about that, particularly because some of the most severely affected regions are likely to be regions that are already vulnerable to climate change. So with that in mind, there's a lot of interest in attempting to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. That was a big part of the meetings in Copenhagen last year, trying to reach international agreement on this important issue. It's a difficult one to come to grips with because everyone's involved and everyone contributes a bit to this. So the idea with ethanol is that perhaps by growing a renewable fuel, we could lower these emissions. And so I think up until a couple of years ago, most everyone was on board with this idea that ethanol would be good for energy security, it would be good for rural incomes, it would be good for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And it was only after really the train was leaving the station in that regard that some work was published. This was work published in Science magazine, very influential magazine, suggesting that perhaps the greenhouse gas emissions benefits were overstated, and that particular study suggested that, in fact, rather than greenhouse gas emissions reductions, there'd be vast increases. And their argument was that if we divert corn to ethanol production, but don't do anything to the demand for food, well, someone else will need to produce that corn, or potentially produce the crops displaced by the corn production as it expands in the U.S. So that gave rise to this whole argument about indirect land use impacts of ethanol production or biofuel production in general. And given the importance of the issue and given the fact that that initial publication in Science was done with a framework that wasn't publicly available for all of us to use, we decided to get involved in that and see whether we could take another look at this and bring some additional science to bear on the question. And we were asked to do that in a way that anyone else could pick up our modeling framework and try it themselves and challenge the results. So bring this out into the public debate, given the importance of the issue, and to bring some modern science in terms of economic science to bear on that. And the theme of the paper really is about the economic element of this. There are many dimensions to the argument.
So you and your colleagues then got together, researched, and wrote a paper entitled it Effects of U.S. Maize Ethanol on Global Land Use and Greenhouse Gas Emissions, Estimating Market Mediated Responses. I'll get to that second part in a moment. But what were the differences that you found in this research compared to that initial set of research?
So in our work, we found that the greenhouse gas emissions from indirect land use change were much smaller than that earlier study. dramatically so, about a quarter of the size. So that's the first. That was the most important thing from our perspective, is that we felt like this earlier work had greatly overstated the greenhouse gas emissions impacts of ethanol. And because their modeling framework wasn't available to us, we weren't able to replicate their work. But to our best of our knowledge, we think that essentially it comes down to different assumptions about the economic response. And we have a figure in the paper that really highlights how important the market responses to ethanol production are in reducing the amount of land use change as a result of that. There are issues such as yield changes in response to higher prices that go a long way towards making up reducing the need for land expansion. There's demand responses, there are co-product effects, and there are other resource effects of other price effects throughout the economy. So in the end, while our initial calculation suggests that for the increment we're looking at, and this is in metric terminology for this international journal, we were looking at an increase in 50 gigaliters per year of maize ethanol production, so it's about 13 billion gallons a year. And initial calculations suggested you might need another 15 million hectares of land to do this. In the end, we find less than 4 million hectares are required. So a great reduction in the total indirect land use impacts because of the market-mediated effects. That's our main finding, that the market-mediated effects are important, and we try to carefully document those and show the areas of uncertainty, because there's a lot of uncertainty in these effects. And we try to quantify that.
Yeah, and so when you talk about the number of hectares, that 4 million hectare amount, is that additional land that's not currently being used as a working farmland? So does it ignore the change from pasture land, for instance, to maize in somewhere specs? I know it doesn't completely, because I read the research, but how does it deal with the way farmland changes from one crop, say hay or pasture, to another crop?
That's right. So that figure is area converted to cropland, okay? In our framework, we allowed the land to come either from pasture or from forest. So if you looked at the world and divided up the land cover into categories, there would be some additional categories. There's tundra, there's shrubland, there's urban land. We didn't allow those to change. We only looked at competition between cropland and pasture, cropland and forest. So most of the cropland's coming from pasture. Then within the cropland category, of course, there is quite a bit of reconfiguration of what's grown where. Obviously, we saw that in the U.S., during the initial corn price spike, we saw a big response in corn area, some of that displacing soybeans, wheat, other crops, going from rotation to continuous corn, that kind of thing. And then a response on the other side as the price of soybeans went up. So we account for the reconfiguration of what is grown on the cropland, obviously an expansion of corn being an important part of this, but other crops also adjusting. So that's the first margin of adjustment. Keep the cropland constant and see what other crops you grow, to the extent we might grow less of a given crop in the U.S. in response to the expanded corn production. We'd expect that to initiate a response in the rest of the world. So soybeans might respond in Brazil or Argentina and so on. And so we look at the global configuration of crop production on cropland, and then we also look at the potential expansion of cropland, both in the U.S. and overseas. And it's that expansion of cropland that we're focused on here, because that is where the main carbon release comes from, either from converting pasture to crop or converting to forest crop. And the amount of carbon released when you convert these things to cropland depends on where in the world if a conversion occurs, and the carbon density of the forest or the pasture in that region. So obviously, the tropical, the worst case scenario of converting a tropical forest to cropland is that that's been the big fear of the environmentalists concerned about biofuels, but there might be a lot more of that. That isn't a big part of the total 4 million hectares, but it is a piece of that. Of the picture.
How big a piece of it?
I'm just looking at, in this study, figure one. I assume maybe you can post the study. It's on your website.
I can
share the PDF with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's figure one is really the key figure in this regard. It shows the hectare distribution across continents. So actually, in our study, we find that most of the conversion of cropland occurs in the U.S. That's quite different from the earlier study, and that has to do with our view of international trade, which is very much a geographic view, that if you have an increase in cropland, an increase in price, corn price in the U.S., that the response is not going to be uniform around the world. There's going to be stronger response in the U.S. and in our major trading competitors, and a weaker response in closed economies like India. That was very different from the earlier study done. So the first part of that figure shows where the hectare conversion is. As I say, most of that new cropland's coming out of pasture. The second shows the carbon releases. And despite the fact that forests are the minority of the land conversion, forests are the majority of the carbon releases, and that's because of the much higher carbon intensity of forests. Still, though, most of the emissions come actually from within the U.S., not from Brazil or overseas.
What does your work say as a whole about ethanol as a fuel related to greenhouse gases and its ability or inability, one of the two, to mitigate greenhouse gas or global warming?
Right. So, really important point. That's really the bottom line of all of this. So, in this work, which we effectively completed a year ago, because this was done by request of the California Air Resources Board, and it was funded by the Energy Biosciences Initiative out of the University of California. So that's a BP-funded I guess the BP is not very popular these days, but they have been funding work on renewables, and they funded that joint project, University of Illinois, your home turf, and California under the Energy Biosciences Initiative. Quite a bit of money has been plowed into doing research on renewables, and they funded this work. And this was done, completed about a year ago. And at the time, what we knew at the time, we suggested that there'd be a slight reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from ethanol relative to gasoline, but pretty minor. Not the kind of major reduction that people were looking for to meet the low-carbon fuel standard in California. We also tried to put uncertainty bounds on this, so we did a fair amount of bounding analysis. What if we're wrong on this? What if we're wrong on that? And you'll see in the conclusion of the paper, those who are interested, we report those bounds, and they're very large. Since this work has been completed in the last year, we use this to highlight the big areas of uncertainty. And one of the biggest areas of uncertainty for us, where we found almost no work had been done, had to do with what I would call the extensive margin of agricultural response. And that is, if you expand the area, agricultural area in Indiana, you expand, say, corn production in southern Indiana, or in Brazil, you expand into what they call the Cerrado region, or elsewhere in the world, you expand crop area. Will yields fall off or not?
Can we take that up in the second half of our program?
Sure can. Yeah.
Absolutely. We're talking with Thomas Hertl. He's the executive director for the Center for Global Trade Analysis at Purdue University. More in a moment. I have a question for you, and it's pretty simple, though I need an honest answer. Many of you have called and written and talked to us just a bit about this program we call The Farming World. And you say, yes, we like The Farming World. We think it's a program that's worth listening to. I've also heard that it makes the program awfully long. An hour is a long time during your day. What I want to know honestly from you is whether you think it's worth doing or not. It's important to us to know whether this program, The Farming World, is something that makes a difference to you and helps you to understand agriculture. If not, we need to change The Farming World or to do something different. It certainly is a lot of work for both Dave Dickey and I. I don't want to get out of the work. I just want to know whether the work we're doing is worthwhile. So if you like it or if you don't like it, please do give me a call or write me an email. The numbers are 217-333-9697, that's 217-333-9697, or email to tgleason@illinois.edu. That's tgleason@illinois.edu. Please do be honest about the program. We really want to know whether it's worth your time and ours. This is The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're talking with Tom Hertle. He's the Executive Director for the Center for Global Trade Analysis at Purdue University and the co-author of a paper called Effects of U.S. Maize Ethanol on Global Land Use and Greenhouse Gas Emissions, Estimating Market-Mediated Responses. When we last spoke with Mr. Hertle, we had just gotten to the topic of how land use changes in the United States might change yields and what that might mean. Can you please continue on?
Yes. So one of the big puzzles is how much yields might fall off as you expand cropland into new areas. So if it takes 3 acres of marginal land to replace 2 acres of average cropland, well, then you've got to have more marginal land coming. You've got to do more conversion in order to meet this additional demand for food, fiber, fuel products from agriculture. So that was a critical assumption in our work. We had very little to go on. We basically based our estimate of this 3-to-2 ratio, in fact, on some work that had been done on the conservation reserve in the U.S., but it was very informal. Since that time, and one of our main results in this was to call for more work on that. Since that time, my colleagues and some work done for Argonne National Labs teamed up with a fellow from Earth and Atmospheric Sciences here at Purdue to use what they call a terrestrial ecosystem model to estimate this. And they would look at the productivity, inherent physical productivity of land around the world and ask whether they could answer this question. And when they've done that, they found that the fall off in yields was not as great as we had assumed. And that resulted in their report, their Argonne report. There are many differences, but this is the main difference, in my opinion, suggesting that there was very likely a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, ethanol relative to gasoline. But their sensitivity analysis suggested that it was unlikely that the reduction would be 20%. Now, that's based on kind of current ethanol conversion technology. Getting a reduction out of this is important, although to tell the truth, when it comes to the U.S. regs on this, the renewable fuel standard, it looks like pretty much enough ethanol capacity has been grandfathered in that it is not subject to the greenhouse gas reduction requirement. Enough is there to meet the current renewable fuel standard, and that the big constraint on ethanol production now is the blend wall, and that is that's what we're bumping up against, the inability to mix more ethanol with the gasoline, inability to go beyond 10% or effectively 9% nationwide in the U.S. And that's really the binding thing right now on ethanol expansion. So it's kind of shifted. I think over the last year, the terrain has shifted from a heavy focus on greenhouse gas, getting greenhouse gas certification to expand, open up further ethanol production, to basically the blend wall has become the main focal point, the main constraint on ethanol expansion.
Do you suppose your paper and the one that is sponsored by Argonne are a couple of the reasons why that's happened?
I think not actually. it's really kind of shifted. It's a question of what is the constraining factor in the system, okay? And we thought perhaps that people were focused a year ago on the constraining factor was getting this to be approved as a green-friendly fuel and getting and expanding the renewable fuel mandate. Well, now we've realized that absent a massive fleet of E85 vehicles and a set of gas stations to deliver that fuel, the constraining factor is not in this renewable fuel standard, but it's rather the blend wall and the ability to use the fuel, the ethanol that we're already producing, and the ability for that to be absorbed in the liquid fuel system in the U.S. So I think currently there is idle capacity out there, and it's idle because we're up against this blend wall. So there is a debate now about expanding that from 10 to 15% or somewhere in between, and that would relax that constraint, at least for the time being.
I do have one final question for you. It's on timeline. I read just a bit in the article, or one of them, that the longer ethanol was used, the more effective it was, and that if it were, and on the opposite end, that if it were quickly phased out, whatever good it did for greenhouse gas emissions and reduction would be quickly eliminated or not there and present at all. Is that right?
You know, one of the most important factors in this is how long will the facilities be operated. So if you view the capacity question as one of being not just having the ethanol facilities, but also having the land in production to deliver to those facilities. The longer you can operate the ethanol facility, the longer that is in this renewable fuel mix, the longer the period over which you can spread out these one-time emissions, the better ethanol looks. So one reason why in EPA's calculations ethanol came out looking better is that they used a longer time frame.
Mr. Hertl, thank you so much, and I hope we can talk to you again in the future.
Okay, my pleasure.
Tom Hertl is the Executive Director for the Center for Global Trade Analysis at Purdue University. Joined us here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You have a good afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason for Dave Dickey. He books the program.